Loud. Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of the Magnified with Matt Cooper podcast series. It's something a little bit different today because I've invited our guest to talk about a piece of work that she has completed over the last 5 or 6 years, which culminated in a major television documentary in recent days, Bishop Eamon Casey's Buried Secrets. Now, if you're my age, my generation, late 50s, you'll remember Bishop Eamon Casey very, very well. He was such a prominent figure on Irish television screens, on radio. He was sort of the modern Catholic bishop. He was regarded as an entertainer, a charismatic figure. He was very much looked up to by the media and by politicians and by the general public. And he was, of course, a complete fraud, as we subsequently discovered, oh, many years later, 1992, when we discovered that he had fathered a child and that he had disowned that child. Something we'll get into during this particular podcast with Anne Sheridan, who is the news editor of the Irish Daily Mail, but who has worked for the last 6-7 years on this story in her time as a reporter with the Irish Mail on Sunday before moving to her job. And as I said, for this new RTE documentary, which outlines a range of crimes committed by Eamon Casey, for which he was never convicted. And I know there are some of you who might say, well, he was never convicted, so you shouldn't be saying these things. The evidence is so credible that you're going to hear about from Anne Sheridan in this particular podcast. And our thanks again to the support from Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of BEV electric vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business. And Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. So with this, I think, essential window to the way Ireland was before and how we still don't necessarily fully deal with what has happened in the past. Here, listen to Anne Sheridan. Anne Sheridan, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us today.
Thank you.
This is an extraordinary story. And I suppose I better explain to listeners why I'm so interested in it. I'm a lot older than you. I grew up in the era when Bishop Eamon Casey was an almost constant fixture on of our television screens. Himself and another fellow who I would also loathe, Father Michael Cleary. And these were the sort of the entertainers of the Catholic Church who were regularly appearing on The Late Late Show and other television shows. Hillfellows well met, great crack, you know, modern Irish Catholicism, and yet deeply conservative and yet deeply instructing people as to how they were to behave, particularly in relation to their sexuality. And these men were complete and utter frauds. But not only were they frauds, there were specific victims of their actions. And Bishop Eamon Casey is a man who did far worse than we had been led to believe. Am I accurately summing up Bishop Eamon Casey as you, a younger woman who've done the investigation into him, has discovered?
I think you are, yes. I mean, I think the word paedophile would have been used a lot in recent days. We know by now, and I think a lot of people thankfully watched the programme the other night, even though it was only promoted 2 days beforehand, we had about 490,000 people tuning in live to RTE1, and many more people have followed since on the player, which is great for us, and it's great for Patricia Donovan, his niece, Bishop Casey's niece, who initially came forward in 2005, and she reported her allegations to the UK police and the Gardaí at that point in time. Now, the Director of Public Prosecutions later decided in August 2006 that there would be no prosecution against him at that point.
And a point here which I think is important to make, that there will still be people, and there were people in the documentary who choose to defend Eamon Casey and say that nothing was proven against him. But the Director of Public Prosecutions often makes decisions not on the basis of deciding that the person who has been investigated is innocent. It's just a calculation made that it may be too difficult to secure a conviction on the he said, she said basis.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about a lot of these cases go back to the 1960s. There is the reliability of memory, not only the memory of the people making the complaints, but there are other people's memories, recollection of events. People who could have been corroborating witnesses in certain cases such as these may well have died. They may be unwilling to cooperate. You're also talking about issues within families and massive fractions that can occur when there are multiple allegations of child sexual abuse made against a number of individuals made within one family. It can make it all the more difficult.
If we were on radio, I would be emphasising that this might be very distressing to listen to, and that if you have children, maybe turn the radio off. I suppose the podcast is somewhat different and that our listeners are opting in deliberately to listen to this. So less detailed, unfortunately, the terrible ordeal that Eamon Casey's niece had to go through because she was raped as a child. This is like this monstrous taxi driver, Raymond Shorten, who we've been talking about in recent weeks, and the atrocious things that he has done. And he's had his first sentence of 13 years imprisonment for raping a little girl a month after her mother had died. And yet here we have essentially Casey being accused of exactly the same thing.
Yes, Patricia claims that she was raped from the age of five, that she was sexually abused, that it continued on for more than a decade. She grew up in Limerick, obviously, in the family home. She said at that time that Bishop Casey was a god in the family, not just a god in the family. He was viewed as God almost, to the whole country, because at that point in time, she claims that the abuse started while he was a priest in Limerick. It continued into his tenure in London, as well as in during his time as Bishop of Galway and also Bishop of Kerry. So it had a massive long lasting impact on her. What is also worth pointing out is that she also claims that the alleged abuse happened before his relationship and affair with Annie Murphy, and it also continued after that point, after Bishop Casey's son Peter was born. Now it's hard to reconcile, I think, for a lot of people, all those facts in your head, really. So Patricia came forward in 2005. She made her allegations known to the police, to the Gardaí, and the story kind of went nowhere because there was no prosecution. At that time, she was never identified. Now, there were a number of identifying details that would have been printed in some national media, which were a great cause of concern and distress to her at this time. And those details which were leaked into the public domain, and we actually believe that they were leaked by Bishop Casey himself, happened before the Gardaí even had a chance to travel over from Limerick to interview her in the UK. So it was reported in a number of national newspapers and local as well, that the way they described Patricia Donovan without naming her was that this was a person that he had known most of her life, that she had endured bouts of ill health, and that she had made similar unproven allegations against others. So
they were trying to undermine her.
Yes, I think her reputation was tarnished, really. It was a smear campaign by Bishop Casey. Now, that might seem like a bold statement to make, and it is. I did speak to, as part of the initial investigation with the Irish Mail on Sunday, I did speak to Bishop Willie Walsh, who was the Bishop of Killaloe, and he did make statements at that time similar to those remarks that were printed, not exactly those words, but quite similar. And it was years later in 2019 that I spoke to him on a number of occasions. He then issued an apology to Patricia Donovan. He said he was very sorry for what he had said, with the benefit of hindsight and the knowledge that he has gained in the meantime, that he would not have expressed confidence then that Bishop Casey's name would be cleared. He also said, quite crucially, I was simply quoting Bishop Casey. So
Bishop Casey was believed no matter what he said, no matter what his track record. And what's also interesting about that is when you say that she had made allegations about others, one of the most shocking things in the documentary was her own brother, who became a priest, who was also an abuser, and who then was moved by Bishop Eamon Casey to protect him.
Yes, yeah, that's correct. That's
Tell us a little bit more about that, him and what happened then with Casey in relation to that.
That's Patricia Donovan's brother, Father Michael Donovan. He was ordained a priest for the Diocese of Limerick in 1983. Not long after that, there were allegations of abuse made against him by an altar boy in Limerick. There was a High Court case which resulted in damages being paid out of in the region of about £30,000 at that point in time. But then after a number of allegations surfaced, he was quietly moved from the Diocese of Limerick to the Diocese of Galway. I think he was initially based in Ennistymon in County Clare, which actually falls under the Diocese of Galway. So as we revealed in the programme on Monday night, that a number of experts would have told us that at that time that Bishop Casey would have had to, in their words, cut a deal with the then Bishop of Limerick, Dr. Jeremiah Newman, for this to happen, for him to be simply moved around the country, even though there was obviously child safeguarding concerns present.
You see, that might sound to many people like, my God, outlandish, that couldn't have happened. But that actually happened on a regular basis at the time. We've learned in this since the mid-1990s that on a regular basis with priests, with brothers, Christian brothers and other denominations, and also sometimes with nuns, that if an allegation or accusation, credible accusations were made, even with guilt, rather than the Gardaí even brought in, basically cover-ups were put in place and these offending religious members were just moved somewhere else where they often just continued with their depredations.
Yes, I mean, it was a very regular occurrence. We had confirmation from the Limerick Diocese in the programme as well on Monday night that what happened, according to the Limerick Diocese, would have had to have been approved by the then Bishop of Limerick, Dr. Jeremiah Newman. And they said that this was unacceptable and should not have happened.
Go back a little bit to Bishop Casey's earlier life as Father Casey in Limerick, because what was also shocking in the documentary was what appears to have been an abuse by him of his position at one of the Magdalene laundries in Limerick. Tell us about that, please.
He was Bishop Casey, or Father Casey then. He was initially ordained a priest again for the Diocese of Limerick. His time there really seemed to go under the radar a little bit. We discovered in files that he was chaplain to St. Joseph's Reformatory School and Magdalene Laundry in the late 1950s for 3 years. Now, when I was initially working with the Mail on Sunday, I was aware of the identity of one of the complainants who had taken a High Court case against him. We can now say with the consent of her family or her surviving family that lady's name is Ellen Murphy. Now, she was someone who spent 18 years in state care. Initially, she was placed in state care because it was the view of the state at that time that her own parents weren't sending her to school often enough, or that she had missed a number of days in school. Now, one of the ironic and profoundly sad things, I think, is that when she finally left the laundries and the reformatory schools 18 years later, and she left from Donnybrook in Dublin at that point in time, she could neither read nor write.
She was just used as an indentured slave, effectively, in the laundry.
She was, yeah, I think.
Under the excuse of, she's not getting schooling. And then to be brought in where you would expect, at the very least, that there would be appropriate care for her. She wasn't even given a basic education. And as she has alleged, and I think with great credibility, she was abused by Eamon Casey.
Yes, she was. We managed to obtain, she initially took a case to the High Court in 2001. So from what we can establish, she is the very first known accuser against Bishop Eamon Casey. Now, she did drop that High Court action because it was then the Residential Institutions Redress Board then became available. It was seen possibly maybe as a quicker or an easier route to go down. So she went that avenue instead, and she was eventually awarded a settlement of over €40,000 plus a similar amount in costs. Now, we did, however, get her statement of claim that she did make to the High Court at that point in time. She outlined two instances of alleged sexual abuse against Father Casey, as he was then known. On one occasion, she said, and she identified the nun in her statement of claim, she said it was a nun who brought her into, or asked her to go into the convent parlour with tea and cakes to where Father Casey was then sitting in the convent parlour. And that's when the alleged first instance of sexual abuse happened.
We won't go into the details because they're actually, in his part, I think a degree of perversion, I think, as well as to his behaviour. And I don't think we'll bring that to the listeners. But as I'm listening to you say this, what pops into my head, and I'm sure you've heard this mentioned many times in recent days, here's an Irish Jimmy Savile. Now, he wasn't the famous person he subsequently became at that stage, but there we have this sort of charismatic individual to whom the nuns would also show a degree of deference, and him abusing that power and position for that poor young woman, young girl as she would have been at the time, and that continuing throughout his life. It's just one of the many shocking things about the way he was allowed. I mean, is a Jimmy Savile comparison outrageous?
No, I don't think it is. I think an awful lot of people have made that comparison in recent days. I mean, again, you know, the two of them were showmen. They had huge personalities that kind of represented, in a way, a cloak, and it kind of protected them, because a lot of people had this perception that, you know, they were, as in the words of Patricia Donovan, Bishop Casey presented as this lovable rogue. And that was many people's perception of him, which seemed almost impenetrable. And then added to that, you had the protection, obviously, that the church had afforded to him. You had a man who appeared on the Late Late Show with Gay Byrne on numerous occasions. And I think Gay Byrne at one point said, "We'd like to welcome back our old and valued friend, Bishop Casey." So he was bulletproof, really. And
hiding in plain sight, I think, is the expression, isn't it? You can get away with an awful lot if you're hiding in plain sight. Was she the only woman in Limerick before he moved to London that he abused, or a girl that he abused?
No, there were three allegations in Limerick in total. So there was Ellen Murphy's complaint in 2001. There was Patricia Donovan's complaint in 2005. And I think it's important to say that when Patricia came forward in 2005, she had no knowledge of the 2001 claim. She was stepping forward, you know.
She thought she was the first.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And then we also have another complaint that was lodged again in Limerick in 2014. And then that went to the High Court in 2016. There was a settlement then after he died, a settlement for in the region of over 100,000 euros.
Made by who? Who made the settlement? His estate or the Catholic Church?
It was the Diocese of Limerick who eventually awarded the monies to this lady, who we're not going to identify, obviously. But Limerick Diocese also confirmed that the Bishop of Limerick, Dr. Brendan Leahy, did meet with this woman personally and did hear about her concerns.
Tell us about his time in London, because, you know, there can be bad people who do good things. And he had a reputation of being an excellent worker on behalf of emigrants to London. But I wonder, did he again use his position with vulnerable women to exploit them?
It's highly possible. I think there is a little bit of a gap in the narrative of this story in terms of when the offending definitely began and when it ended. We don't really have those firm bookmarks in the story yet. We know that he went to London in the 1960s, and it was there really that his star was on the rise, and that other people in the church saw the impact he was making. He appeared in the RT programme Ryark, very energetic, very dynamic, was motivating the Irish community there, was helping people with homeless issues. So he represented something new for the Catholic Church, in a way to slightly remodel or represent itself. So that was really how he was appointed then Bishop of Kerry at the relatively young age of 42, which was then quite young to be a bishop. We do know that there were complaints against him in the 1960s with and those were complaints made by adult women who said that they had adult sexual relations with Bishop Casey in the 1960s. And the church said that they regarded these relations or these acts, as did the women, as an abuse of trust. Now, we don't know exactly how he abused the trust of these adult women. We don't know definitively that they definitely happened in London. That was the period he was based in London. Now, he was over and back between London and Limerick quite a lot at that point in time.
Which brings us to, I suppose, the most famous story about him, the one that led to his downfall in 1992. And again, I would have been working as a journalist at that stage. I remember so well what happened and the extraordinary story, and even the extraordinary way in which the Irish Times actually justified the publication of the details of the fact that he had had a relationship with this woman, Annie Murphy, that the son Peter had been born, who was now an adult, but they justified publication on the basis that he had misappropriated diocesan funds as a sort of a pay to pay for his education and various other payoffs. It is, in some respects, so. And you mentioned Gay Byrne, and Gay Byrne interviewing Annie Murphy in the television, and that absolutely famous clip which you have in the documentary, in which he said that if Peter grew up to be half the man his father was, he'd be a very good man. And she said, well, you know, I'm not a bad person either. And I thought it was one of the most wonderful comebacks in that situation. But what was very clear as well, again, what I was reminded of in watching your documentary, in that how much, again, of an abuse of trust it was, that her family members, she had been going through a difficult time, young woman divorced in the US, in an emotional state, and he preyed upon her. He just started, more or less, she was hardly in the country, and there he is, 20, 25 years older than her, and he swoops in, he preyed on her. And I use the word prey deliberately.
He did. That would be the view, I think, of a lot of people. Now, Annie Murphy, in her book Forbidden Fruit, she describes the moment she arrived at Shannon Airport, and she said the atmosphere between them and the spark almost was almost electric, and it seemed almost inevitable that something was going to happen with them. She later then went on Morning Ireland with Donal Byrne. And it was, you know, a magnificent piece of radio after the story was published by the Irish Times. But now you had her in her own words describing this. And she said it was almost like I was his mistress, and it was the most magical thing that she had encountered in her life. Now, she almost presented it in somewhat glowing, favourable terms, but then she revealed the other side to Bishop Casey, that when her son Peter, or their son Peter, was born in 1974, he very much wanted her to give the baby up for adoption. He told her that she was evil, that it was God's will that the baby be given up for adoption, and she described him almost as like a Machiavellian character. A lot of the language used in relation to evil and the terminology around that would have been similar to what he said to Patricia Donovan, who also claims that she was sexually abused. Annie Murphy doesn't claim that. But again, it was the use of the phrase evil, and he would have mentioned that. And maybe I don't want to mention the exact context of that. But he used that terminology of good and evil to women quite a lot, it seems.
God, make them take responsibility for his actions.
Yes.
Evil would be a good description of the way he was behaving. Did he ever subsequently have a relationship with his son Peter, who, I'm just calculating, is 50 years old now?
I don't think they really had. Peter later said in later years that they never really had a father-son relationship. I think the first time he met him was when he was 15, in the offices of a lawyer in New York. And Peter said years later that when he met his father, he got the impression that he represented the end of everything that he had worked for his entire life. I think it was very, very difficult for him.
Yeah, because the good life as well, because when we talked about Jimmy Savile earlier, and you know, Jimmy Savile with his flamboyant clothing and the medallions, Eamon Casey with his clerical garb and the various other accoutrements that come with that. But I think what probably wasn't as well known as well was that Eamon Casey liked living the high life, didn't he? I mean, he had a reputation for excessive speeding in sports cars. And he liked his drink, his expensive drink, didn't he, as well, and cigars and the like.
He did. He liked lavish dinners, lunches out. He liked fine wines. He liked brandy. He liked his cigars. He liked fast racing cars. He quite famously drove around Mondello Park one time, and he appeared on the Mike Murphy Show on RTE. Now, it was to raise money for the homeless in Galway at that point in time, but
Jim will fix it. Eamon Casey will fix it.
Yeah, he appeared on the Mike Murphy Show, and Dermot Morgan was actually there alongside him, ironically lampooning the Catholic Church. And I think even Dermot Morgan struggled to get a word in edgeways with Bishop Casey. He just really completely took over the whole show. And I know from interviewing people over the course of this, loads of them had stories about almost reckless driving, in Kerry in particular, also about his drinking. I remember one person told me that Bishop Casey eventually arrived late for a meeting. He pulled out a bottle of whiskey, slammed it down on the table and said, "Right, who has the glasses?" And they were taken aback. Now, they found it funny, but also obviously quite inappropriate as well too for a bishop at that time.
But he could get away with it.
He could, yes.
He thought he could walk on water.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, well, it was also in the documentary, and it's again one of the reasons why I'm interested in all of this. As I said at the outset, I mean, I remember all the TV appearances. Don't remember that one in Mandela Park, but, you know, I remember him on the Late Late Show at times and whatever. And I also was in Galway at the Pope's Mass in 1979. I was a 13-year-old. I was supposed to be 16 and up, but a whole gang of us ended up travelling up there for it. And himself and the aforementioned Michael Cleary holding court before introducing the Pope and the rest of it and just lapping it up and loving it, supposedly the modern clergy. And when you think of the hypocrisy, because I also know Cleary said desperate things about people, you know, who spoke about sex freely in 1990s Ireland, and the hypocrisy of him as well as the hypocrisy of Casey. Sorry if I'm going on about this. I just find the whole thing absolutely nauseating, the way they behaved. And yet, his escape from Ireland from the Peter Murphy, Annie Murphy situation was facilitated by the Catholic Church, wasn't it? No, he committed no crime as such in relation to that, but they let him get away with things, didn't they?
They would certainly appear to. I mean, I think we have to remember that, you know, the church ultimately is designed to protect itself, and it's going to do whatever it potentially can to minimise the scandal and the risk to its own reputation. Eamon Casey claimed himself in the podcast that he did, not a podcast, in an interview he did, I think it was with Life and Lore many years ago with the Kerryman, that he flew to Rome, he offered his resignation to the Pope, and he claimed that the Pope actually refused to accept it. But eventually the Pope acquiesced to his demand that he would have to step down as the Bishop of Galway.
What can we believe in relation to that?
I know, exactly, yeah. So then he spent 6.5 years in the missions in Ecuador as a missionary priest.
Well, actually, can I say one of my best friends, the late Veronica Guerin, tracked him down.
That's right.
And there was enormous fuss at the time when she broke the story for the Sunday Tribune newspaper. And yeah, and I remember actually then not long afterwards, funnily enough, Casey came back to Ireland because my wife, Aileen, and myself were driving through the Temple Bar, going into park a car there one day. And we saw Casey out in the street going into one of the hotels. And I was just about to hop out and run after him. Next thing I saw, Veronica heading in after him. And clearly she was in for another meeting for more information off him. So I hopped out, couldn't find them afterwards, sort of slagged her afterwards about how I'd been trying to chase Casey down as well. But he did sort of continue to come in and out. And then he almost portrayed himself as a victim. And the other thing I was really taken by, brilliant use of footage in your documentary, all of the people at the time who sort of defended him and more or less said, well, if he succumbed to sin, it was because Eve had tempted him with the apple. Mm-hmm. It wasn't his fault at all. My God, if only people had known all the other stuff he was up to.
I know. I mean, when you look back on it now with the benefit in hindsight and how far we have come since Annie Murphy appeared on The Late Late Show, I mean, she was almost presented then as this type of femme fatale
Scarlet
character.
Scarlet woman.
Yes. It was almost like it would have been impossible for him to resist her temptations. And that was the view that a lot of people outside Galway Cathedral at that time when they were interviewed for a Vox Pop said as well. I think one lady said, well, the devil is out there to tempt us all.
That's right. That was in I saw that and I was going, oh my God, that's just so, so shocking. You mentioned Galway Cathedral, but the other thing that's quite extraordinary is, despite the fact that more and more information became available before he died, despite the fact that the church was making settlements, that he got buried in the crypt at Galway Cathedral, which is the type of thing you would almost assume would be reserved for special dignitaries of the Catholic Church. I mean, that was no shunning of him. Even if he had been stopped from practicing his ministry in the previous decade, an instruction which clearly you showed he didn't follow and still held himself out to be a priest of good standing, that they would then sort of claim an administrative mix-up or almost like it fell between the cracks. They didn't know who was responsible for what, that they went through the big ceremony burying him in the crypt.
Yes, there's very many issues actually associated with the funeral itself and how it was presented to the public, the whole optics of it, and then kind of privately what happened behind the scenes, and almost, I think, the conflict in the church of what to do. On the one hand, you had someone who was removed from ministry by the Vatican in 2007, so 10 years before his burial. With anyone who is accused with a credible complaint of child sexual abuse, and we know there were 5 against Bishop Casey, you are meant to receive what is very much a toned down funeral burial. It has to be very respectful. respectful and cognizant of the victims and what they have suffered. So it's not meant to be lavish, opulent, or opulent. It's not meant to give the impression that someone was a priest in good standing. There are strict guidelines by the Catholic Church. Now, they're normally reserved for priests removed from ministry. For a long time, it's been inconceivable to senior members of the Catholic Church that a bishop could actually do this. So there isn't a separate set of guidelines for a bishop. Now, from what my sources told me, in the eyes of some members of the clergy, that the funeral he received, even though it was attended by up to 1,600 people, there was 11 bishops in attendance, there was 61 priests. In their eyes, it was a toned-down service.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Toned down, is that what you call it?
Toned down.
All right.
Yes, yeah. That in their eyes, that he was called out as a sinner from the altar by Bishop Brendan Kelly on a number of occasions. Now, there are, I think, 7 distinct references to sin in the homily. My sources pointed me to some aspects of his religious life that were never presented. They said that his family didn't bring up any emblems of his religious life to the altar. They brought up the family crest. And I think another emblem of his time was as the chairman of Trocra. They said there was no mitre present, no pall over the coffin, no pectoral cross. The bishop's ring wasn't there. And that was their compromise, it seems.
Yeah. So he was a sinner. Criminal is what I would say. And this is the other thing which I suppose will annoy a lot of people. I hope it would annoy a lot of people. This idea that being stopped from saying Mass was an appropriate punishment for the crimes he committed. Why wasn't all this information handed over to An Garda Síochána?
Well, we do know that when the complaints were received, they were handed over to Gardaí. What we don't know is if there are potentially any other complaints against him to the redress board. Now, Limerick has told us that there was one complaint that related to the redress board. But under the terms of the redress board at that time, they couldn't have handed information over to the Gardaí. We also have to remember that the Code of Pontifical Secrecy was only partially lifted in 2019. So for a long time, anyone within the church who shared information in relation to child sexual abuse could have actually been excommunicated from the church if they passed on these kind of grave secrets, grave concerns. So that was only lifted in 2019, that they could be more open, more transparent with various authorities throughout the world in terms of how people are brought to justice effectively.
And you were only a child when the whole Annie Murphy thing happened.
Mm-hmm.
When did you first become aware of Eamon Casey, and in what circumstances?
I think I was 9 actually when the story was broken by the Irish Times in 1992. Now I'm from Kerry, and somewhat ironically, again, my granduncle was a priest in Kerry. And in the footage that we showed on RT the other night, he's actually on the altar when Bishop Casey is being consecrated as the Bishop of Kerry. So while I was very young, when everything kind of blew up in relation to the Eamon Casey revelations at our home in Kerry, my grandmother would often have been there. The door would have been closed. It would have been my granduncle, the priest, and other priests who would come in. And I think it was after that time that there was a lot of kind of secret discussions in kind of the family home about him that I was never really privy to. But it was certainly, there was certainly gossip or a little bit of talk, or talked about it in kind of hushed tones. And I think it's really the Annie Murphy clip. I think that's ingrained in an awful lot of people's minds.
Because it's been replayed so many times over the years. So as you're growing up, you'd become aware of it. So you become aware of the significance of Bishop Casey in Irish life and of that story. What was it like dealing with the women who were telling you the stories of their experiences at the hands of Eamon Casey?
I guess it was traumatic, really. I mean, I think it's really hard to take it in. It's awful to hear. I mean, Patricia contacted me, I think it was in 2018, and we ran the story in 2019. So I would have spoken to her for a very long time over the phone, flew over to the UK then, sat down with her, went through all her various statements to Gardaí, to the diocese, to the then Bishop of Galway, Dr. Martin Drennan. It's completely harrowing, and especially then after learning of Patricia's story to eventually hear the story of Ellen Murphy, which I'd been trying to get for so many years. It was almost like it kind of fell into my lap suddenly at the right time. And I think her story, and people can certainly hear it online, her audio file, if they wish to do so. I think it's just a horrific account.
Because a lot of people like being critical of journalists and how they go about getting stories. But a story like this would have required you to spend not just an enormous amount of time, but also treating these women with a degree of sensitivity as well. Because, you know, you had, they put a trust in you, which you couldn't betray as well. I mean, you're looking to get the story out there, but you also have to do it in a way that is sensitive to their experience. How do you do that?
I think you build up trust with someone, really, and I think that only happens from talking to someone over a long period of time, out of respecting their wishes. I mean, Patricia Donovan's story is huge, not just in exposing Bishop Casey and exposing the church in terms of how they handled her allegations, but I suppose there's a lot of details maybe of the alleged abuse that I certainly wouldn't put into the public domain, because Patricia thinks, okay, I have gone far enough. That's as much as I'll tell you this, but this is as much as I want to say in print, because some of it is just too horrific and it's too horrendous. And it's about her protecting herself as well too, in terms of causing further trauma by revealing so much. So there's kind of only so far sometimes people are willing to go, and you also have to respect that.
And what do you say to some people who appeared on your documentary and others who said it's in small number, you know, that, oh, man can't defend himself, it's unfair to destroy the memory that people have of him by saying these things when he can't defend himself? Because I would say that on occasions when he was given the opportunity to defend himself, he ran.
I think he did. I mean, in terms of the fallout after Annie Murphy, he certainly didn't do himself any favours. He came out and made a statement, and he said that, you know, I acknowledge that Peter Murphy is my son, and I apologise to him, to, you know, to God, to my church, etc. But he still denied his son for many years, and he refused to recognise him as a son at all. And I think that comes across in the programme too from a number of contributors, that whatever about his affair with Annie Murphy, which a lot of people felt was a very human mistake or human transgression, and whatever about the so-called misappropriation of diocesan funds, which was later repaid, the sin for a lot of people was that here was a man who was a Catholic and was not practicing what he preached. He wasn't being Christian-like towards his son. This was also at a time, Peter was born in 1974. In 1975, just a year later, he spoke at an event for Cherish, which was an organisation at that time for unmarried mothers. And he spoke of the need to support unmarried women and to support children born out of wedlock, which was the phrase that people used at that time.
What a hypocrite. Mm. But the hypocrisy is the lesser of his sins or crimes, to put them more accurately. Do you think might there be more to come? Do you think is it possible now that you've brought all of this into the public attention that others may step forward?
I would certainly hope so. I mean, I would very much like that, and I'm definitely available to anyone who wants to come forward and talk to me further about Bishop Casey or their own experience. I think, as we were saying earlier, I think the gap in the narrative is, in London, I believe there is more to come out of that period. We also haven't any confirmation from the Archdiocese of Southwark or the Diocese of Westminster of if they have received any complaints or allegations against him in relation to the 1960s. They've refused to do so. And the curious thing about that point in time as well is when Bishop Casey was coming back to Ireland, the UK, in 1998, there was very much a quandary in the church about who was going to accept him back, because he had caused such a scandal. I don't think anyone actually wanted to deal with him or have him in their parish. But Cardinal Basil Hume of Westminster at the point in time said that there were very many reasons why it would be inappropriate for Bishop Casey to return to his diocese. Now, he didn't elaborate on those reasons, and I think a lot of people interpreted it as relating to Annie Murphy. But now it seems loaded with other context.
OK, well, we'll see what else is produced. But what you've done to date has been invaluable public service journalism. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's Magnified with Matt Cooper. We hope, well, I always say I hope you enjoyed it, but I'm not sure that was particularly a podcast to enjoy, but I think it was illuminating as to a major part of Irish 20th century history and the consequences for Irish women of the abuse by some clerical members of the Catholic Church. There are loads of other different types of interviews that you can go back and listen to and enjoy on Magnified. And if you did like this, please recommend to a friend wherever it is you're listening to it, be it on Apple, Spotify, or of course on the Go Loud app. So again, our thanks to our sponsors, Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Looking to upgrade your business fleet? Choose from a wide range of vehicles local to you. Visit vwfs.ie/business. And Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Until the next time, from me, Matt Cooper, thank you very much for listening.
Go Loud presents Magnified with Matt Cooper. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen Financial Services Business Leasing. Move your business forward with a fleet of commercial or passenger vehicles. Build your fleet to your expectations. Visit vwfs.ie/business.
Volkswagen Financial Services is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Go Loud. Sounds better with us.